Welcome to No Room for Phonies. I think this is episode 93.
It is.
Nailed it.
7 episodes to 100. Pretty good. So today we are continuing our discussion of the book, The Song of Significance, written by Seth Godin, but we have Sebastian here as our both our podcast guest and our technical director. So
director, producer, and
setting up of equipment. So I wanted to start with a big quote. And the quote that I wanted to do is kind of to set off the discussion that we're going to have about some of the points. I just pulled out 10 discussion points from the Song of Significance, which Sebastian listened to, I read, and you've kind of read.
You don't kind of read.
Well,
I'm halfway through.
You're about partway through. So the big quote is that the leader doesn't need to do every element of the project. They need to figure out how to assemble a team that does. And we don't make widgets, we make decisions. And agency comes with responsibility. So anyway, I like that quote from the book by Seth Godin. So I'm sure that some of those things are going to come into some of the discussion that we're going to have when we start talking about the 10 points. But I mean, basically it means that leaders need to be able to figure out who are the best people to have on the team and then give them proper instructions and then let them go, right?
And yes. When they have that sense of responsibility, then they engage in and...
Right. And if they don't think of themselves as just like Lucille Ball on the assembly line putting chocolates in the box, if they actually feel like they can make a decision and that their leader trusts them, then they'll develop a sense of responsibility, right?
Yeah.
Can I?
Absolutely.
I need to interrupt.
Yeah.
The mic is syncing.
Yeah, I see that.
It's okay. We'll take a quick pause.
Why is it sinking?
Because it's heavy.
Because it doesn't know how to swim.
Cool. I just wanted to jump in and say about the quote. I don't exactly remember it from the book exactly like that, but I was wondering what they mean by widgets. Because I know it as an Android or phone tool. A listener might be like, widget. What's a widget?
Widget to me comes from industrial.
Yeah, so a long time ago when economic professors and authors were talking about things being made rather than calling it things or stuff, they called it widgets. So it's a general word for like stuff.
Assembly line things.
Items.
Things that are made on assembly lines.
Instead of using the word gadget, which sounds important, widget doesn't sound important.
Okay, so it's just a widget.
It's assembly line work.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's why I was talking about the Lucille Ball thing, because a lot of people know that of her putting chocolates in and then the conveyor belt speeds up.
I mean,
she can't make a decision to slow that down or to do anything. She's just making widgets.
And failing.
And failing.
And that's the comedy of it.
But she doesn't feel any responsibility for it because she has no control.
So it's not failing. This is what's happening to me. And it's funny in the moment for like us watching Lucy fail. But she doesn't care.
And the thing is, the leadership in that has not enabled their team to do the job.
Right.
Because they're not paying attention to what their skills are.
Yeah.
And putting together a team that can actually do what they've been asked to do.
Right.
So that's, to me, a problem. So anyway, the first discussion point... one of the things that I read in the book, it said, don't become a victim of a system that has outlived its usefulness. And so I just wondered what that meant to you particularly.
To either of us.
To either of you.
What does it mean to be a victim of a system that has outlived its usefulness?
So a system to me that's outlived its usefulness is the manual way of getting a driver's license in the province of Ontario. How you have to go in person to take this test, and then they give you a little piece of paper to sit there And you, it's just the system, and they've got to be right. more efficient ways of.
Well, and
there can be. Well, it's the larger argument of things becoming more online, like more via app, more via you show up and you scan a QR code at the Service Ontario Center, yeah. and then it pops up on your phone that you get a text message saying that your appointment is at this time, and you can go grab lunch and then come back for your appointment, and you don't have to like sit and wait.
And it's the fact that doctors in Ontario still use fax machines.
Right.
When there's encrypted ways of protecting data.
Yeah. And I think lots of the reasons that we're like lots of these examples are probably not that I'm, you know, in Service Ontario or the doctor or hospitals, but it's probably based on budget, because a higher up CEO or owner of a hospital or someone higher up the food chain is saying, well, it's worked this long. So
yeah, they don't want to make
change. They don't want to make that change. Mm-hmm. It's like that's what's happening in my mind. I mean, I don't know
I think sometimes,
but I'm trying to find another example of.
I sometimes think a system that has outlived its usefulness is the idea now that, like, I think there are jobs where we have to be in the building and there, but I also think that the system of pulling everybody in across miles and miles and miles of space to have a meeting.
Oh, that doesn't make sense anymore.
I think that system has outlived its usefulness, because I think that being face to face in a room doesn't necessarily change the meeting.
And I think the biggest part of this argument for like the working from home thing is outliving its usefulness, or like working in an office outliving its usefulness, uh-huh. is the fact that you can't tell someone's emotion through a Zoom meeting. That's the argument. That's like the big argument that gets brought up.
They use all the time, right?
Or we're not in a feel. We don't have a feeling of community in the office anymore, or we don't have a feeling of community because we can only connect via Zoom, via video call. And my argument is, all cameras in the world, all webcams, in a new laptop in a new company are 720 HD. Right. If you can't tell someone's emotion in 720, what's wrong with you?
You need better eyesight.
You need better eyesight. You need not because there are people with disabilities
but that people like have the ability to like turn off their cameras.
Right. And I say I do agree with the notion that if you are working remotely, you should have at least once a week an on-camera meeting.
Yeah.
At some point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One on-camera thing.
Okay, as a language person, there is something to be said for the fact that you can't read body language of the whole body if the person's face is too close to the camera.
Right.
So you miss gestures like dropped shoulders.
Sure.
But you can even miss an eye roll if you're looking at... Person 16 right. on the grid over to the left and person 10 on the grid over on the right eye rolls their eyes.
But I'm going to say straight up.
But there are some things in the world that will never be remote, is my argument to that.
And I held meetings with 10 to 15 people.
And you still don't even see more. It all.
You can't see people eye rolling and doing all that stuff.
But you actually can probably see it better in Zoom.
You can see a sigh. You can see people slouching. You can see the general posture shift.
But
I think online.
But then going further, and
I
this
think
might,
online, we just need to learn to look for those.
And sure. I also think,
but
that
it's the same thing. It's the same thing. It is so close to in person. Yeah. Any CEO or person, a business owner, that's making the argument that Zoom is not good enough, you are wrong. Zoom is good enough.
I think
for certain applications, no, it's not. But that's when you have to be in person. Can a doctor be over Zoom? No.
Can you not set up? Well. I'm fine with a doctor on Zoom.
Well, talking, but if you
but
have
not
a
when you
serious...
want them to actually touch you.
Right.
No, but the doctor that I see in Toronto, he can do a lot in a call.
Yeah.
Right.
If he doesn't feel he can do it in the call, then he says, I'm sorry, you have to come in.
Yeah.
But
we're talking about the jobs that obviously could be done.
Like,
from
I don't
home.
Think yeah, teaching absolutely. Jobs and places where there no. are like, students and all that stuff. I don't think that that's appropriate. People who are student facing and client facing,
yeah,
like in jobs like that. But the other thing is, when I held meetings, I had a meeting protocol. So why can't you just have protocols?
Yeah.
That in place.
Cameras have to be on.
Certain circumstances, well, because there are arguments from other sides of people where like, yeah, okay, you're having a rough, depressed, anxious, stressful day. You don't really feel like turning your camera on. I think there's an argument for that. But I think at least
when you were once a week, you had to be there.
And right. But down. I think once a week, you should be able to like turn your camera on at least.
Right. And if you can't do that, maybe you need
And that's, and if you're not, help. If you're having a large company meeting where you have to talk to everyone in your organization on Zoom and you're expecting everyone to be in person, first of all, that's a little ridiculous because the second part to that is if you're on Zoom, there should be an expectation. Okay. The full company's meeting, we're talking, or there's a big production meeting. Mm-hmm. We're talking with everyone. Turn your camera on.
Yeah.
Like it shouldn't be like, oh, I'm having a bad day on the production meeting day. No, plan ahead a little bit and, you know your schedule and don't overdo yourself or work yourself before that meeting. I don't know.
But these are the things that are just like professionalism and protocol for your company.
When I have training at the college, we have a room protocol. And so you like, because I've gone in person and you definitely have to have your phone off face down and laptops closed because you're in training and you can't multitask. But what they build in then is they build in times because we're all managers.
Yeah.
You can go check your phone,
so answer a few emails,
whatever.
So you can't disregard that need, but.
And my biggest pet peeve in any meeting that I've ever been is someone checking their phone, or I can tell their eyes are darting away.
And that as a teacher, that bugs me when students.
As an argument to that, in general, that way of being, you said you accepted this meeting,
right?
Yeah.
So be here, be present.
Yeah.
If you cannot make a meeting because you have a crazy amount of emails you have to respond to, you know something's coming in that you have to deal with. That's in any job. But I guarantee you, people act that busy, but no one is really that busy.
Yes.
Yeah.
We pretend. I've been there where I'm like, oh, I'm in the office. I'm typing away.
Well, because being busy is also a sign of status for people.
Right.
For a lot of people.
So. Yeah. But anyway, I thought that, I think that like driving in, like there's a lot of things about systems that have outlived their usefulness. I mean, we could talk about that. But I think one of the bigger things is leaders making a decision about when it is actually necessary to assemble everybody and what that could actually mean. I'm talking like for the environment, for people's physical well-being, for people's budgets in paying for gas to drive in and wear and tear, like for leaders to actually make good decisions about when it is necessary.
And then, you know, not at my current organization, if anyone's listening from that, but at past organizations, there's definitely been a notice of, oh yeah, we want to be in the office. And guess who works from home all the time is the CEO of the company.
Oh,
right. Yeah.
That's not cool to me.
No.
Well, and there's lots of organizations where they want people to be in and that CEO is in every day at 6 a.m. And I say, great. But can I work from home? you know what I mean? Like you do you, but like, let's let everyone else make their own decision. It's like one personality, one person should not dictate a crowd at work. Like it shouldn't be
that one decision. And it should be actually based on productivity, not on, and I think in your environment where teachers are like student facing and whatever, the fact that people aren't in very much actually has an impact on productivity because you have to do things as teams. Like you're actually getting resources together and sharing physical resources and things.
And the number of conversations we used to have, just turn your chair around and have a conversation with two people sitting near you, actually helped a lot of stuff happen.
Whereas that probably doesn't occur in your organization.
No, I mean, there's definitely moments in the office where we can say, hey, like, what did you do for this show? And someone has a really brilliant idea. But I could also do that on Zoom chat.
Yeah. Well, you're also are you in that other back chat channel thing?
Back chat channel thing. You're going to be more specific.
The one that starts with S, I can't remember. Switch Swatch.
Switch Swatch?
No.
I'm not in a knitting group. That's you guys.
Very funny.
Anyway, the next thing that he talks about is that everyone in order to feel significant, you need to have agency and dignity in your work.
So
like no matter where you are sort of in the chain of whatever, you should have agency and dignity
so
in your work.
I love Seth Godin's writing, and I like I listen to his audiobook, so I don't maybe take in the information the same way that you do reading the book hard copy.
Oh, I think
but I mean, about
it's
the
all
same.
About the same.
But when he says agency, I don't, like, I can't exactly put my finger on what he means by the word specific agency in that
yeah,
sentence.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would struggle with that meaning of agency because you think of the building or the...
Sure,
the
I understand of, dignity right. very clearly.
So agency is when you want to be an agent for the job that you do. You want to be involved.
Autonomy is another word to me of saying agency.
Yes.
But it's a little bit deeper because... Autonomy means I can work on my own and do my thing.
Okay.
Agency means I have autonomy to the point where people trust me to go and do what I need to do
yeah.
appropriately.
Oh, yes.
Without like... And
see, I like that. I like that word better then in this
that,
in this sentence.
To me, that's what
yeah.
he's meaning by that. It's another level up from autonomy. Autonomy could be I stand at a... widget making machine all day and nobody talks to me, but that's not
want.
Agency,
right?
Because agency means ownership to me.
Okay, that's a good way of putting it as well,
right? And so do the people in your company feel that they have ownership for the success of
yeah
what happens?
I mean, I feel definitely for my organization, I definitely feel like I have agency and dignity in my work.
So I
know
I just looked it up. It's also having a sense that you have influence over the outcome of things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%. Because if...
But that's ownership to me. Like
yeah.
that you own part of the... And you know, the thing that I always felt, and that's, I think, part of the problem of unionized environments... is that the leader is held responsible for everything.
Yeah.
And there's not agency because the union takes away the agency.
Mm-hmm.
Because they say, well, if something's going wrong in your organization, it has to be management's problem.
Right.
And
right.
so that,
which is not always the case.
Well, just look in a private company, how different that is. Everybody is kind of looks at each other, okay, whose fault was it or how did we... How did the problem happen, and then how can we solve it as
well,
a team?
Well, I think an agency that is, or I think a company that's significant,
yeah,
doesn't immediately look to one thing,
no,
to point out the problem.
No.
So that's
no.
where unions have it wrong,
yeah,
yeah,
because it's immediate. Yeah, of course, the union's going to look at the management. That's always how it goes, and management's going to look to the workers. Like that's just.
But when you
that's
when
the cycle.
When
but when you take a step back and say, wait a second. It could be both of our faults.
Yeah.
But that's just a good thing in life in general to
but
say,
so is,
whose fault is it?
But so
let's
is
look into this.
So is success.
Right.
Part everybody's thing too. If there's agency and dignity,
oh,
then everybody
in the negative
has
aspects
a piece,
of also the success.
Everybody has a piece of everything.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And if you've achieved something, it's not just management.
It's as an entire group. Yeah.
And everybody's kind of personalities and ideas and what they bring to the table is respected. And there isn't the eye rolling.
Yeah.
Like in an environment where everybody has agency and dignity, then people don't
roll eyes
and work on other projects while they're at a meeting because
yeah.
They want to be in it. Yeah.
Right. And that isn't always the responsibility of the leader. It also is the responsibility of the person to look for aspects of where they work, where they can add.
Yeah.
And
I think
not just sit back.
I think every leadership team in probably many organizations that I've been a part of, like they want everyone to be involved in meetings. They push for that. They want cameras on. They
mm-hmm.
want this. But sometimes like I don't know what happens, and maybe we'll hit on it in another part here, but we like as usually an employee, like I've been, there's something between that when I'm asked to be present and part of this meeting and almost lectured to do so. There's something in me, and I think there's something in every employee that's like, I don't want to.
Okay, but that comes to the whole point of do you have agency in your company?
Right.
Like if you really feel you have ownership and
you just show up, you don't have to be asked. You
are ready.
You don't have to be asked by leadership.
No. To do and that. I think what happens, so that kind of just leads into the next point about how do we engage in conversations about significant things. And as he says in the book, Seth Godin, if we can't talk about significant things, then we can't really call ourselves professionals. So to me, that means that if you're sitting in a meeting with somebody and they are distracting to you and they are not allowing things, then I should be able to have a significant conversation with that person and say, you know, what's up? Not a stop doing that conversation, but
no, that's
see
petty.
That
that's...
you're struggling. Like one of the things that I said to people all the time, I see that you're struggling. How can I support you? Like some of the behaviors that I'm seeing from you show me that you are struggling. How can I support you? And so it's not just up to the leader to have that conversation. It's up to all of the people in the building to be aware of how everyone else is feeling as a professional and be able to have that conversation.
Yeah. It's just like a willingness to help everyone.
Yes. And you could be also able to have that with your leader.
Yes.
Like to be able to go in and say, hey, you've been really down lately. Like, is there anything that I can do to...
Or like from my side, there's definitely been moments where, you know, we get assigned a whole bunch of different shows and jobs and they're like, oh my gosh, like I can't find a production manager to take on this show. I'm like, well, my calendar's open. I can take that on.
Right.
Like offering help and support in that way.
But if you don't have the significant conversation...
If you don't want to...
then you really aren't a professional because you aren't showing agency. You aren't giving the other person the dignity to say, I'm noticing this about you and I'm here. I'm part of this team.
Right. And I think if you don't have agency, then it's a discussion. Like we're saying all the things like if you don't have agency and you're like, okay, cool. But maybe it's time to think about why.
Right.
And maybe bring those conversations up with your leadership team. If you're feeling like, listening to this conversation, you're already saying, oh, I would never put myself out there and like help someone else in the company because I don't get paid enough or I don't, whatever. Maybe you need to have a discussion. Maybe that's like a sparking.
And then it's the idea that how do you respond to someone who's interrupting you when you are trying to do something significant? Right?
I like that.
Who's kind of like distracting you from the thing that you know is significant and you need to do.
Well, and that's interesting because a manager can interrupt a team that's already working really well on something and throw things off by micromanaging or focusing on one point. Or
for sure.
A team member can interrupt the flow of everything that's happening as well, or can interrupt a manager's overall plan.
Yes.
Right. So. And lots of those in lots of those ways, it's a very personal, petty reason because it's like, I want to do this my way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my way is going to shift everything that we've worked on, but because it's not the way I want it done, I don't care. I'm going to shift it the way so I want it done the way that I want it.
So
I've definitely worked with people like that. And
how did you respond to the
interrupt? Well, usually they're leadership or above me. So usually you just say, okay, no problem.
But I think what Seth Godin is really saying is that we need a different style of leadership where that leader, and one of the things he says is, here's what I've made, help me make it better.
Right.
And so if that's the kind of leadership style that you have in your company, and that's what people are living, then, you know, this is the way we do things here. We all do things, but you should also then be able to have the ability to say, I think it would be better if more people came to the table and gave their ideas.
Right. And I think usually the reason that we are, that that's happening in leadership is because they've done it the same way.
Yes.
Forever and ever and ever.
Yeah.
And maybe they've done it the same way because they haven't upgraded their learning or education. They don't know another solution. So they're just like, this is what we've always done. This is what's safe. This is the way we do things.
Yeah, and
so let's
he talks about safety in the book, like the difference between safety and significance, and how you know
cool.
you have to.
you have to be unsafe at some capacity. Yeah,
and you have to be willing to support each other when everybody is feeling unsafe.
Right.
Right? Because that's scary, mm-hmm. right? So
we've never done this before this way. What's going to happen? Well, it's probably going to open up something in your organization that will make it more significant. Like in most ways that I've seen, like in ways where I've been caught between a manager and something that I want to do a certain way, my first answer to it was, oh, okay, we'll just do it your way because that's easy and that's safe. Right. But in some cases I have gone, well, I understand that you've done it this way the entire time, but maybe if we try this way first, give it a shot, see how it goes. And then we'll, if it doesn't work, we can go back to the original solution.
Right. Right. The and original he way. Is a sure.
And that has worked for you sometimes.
And that has worked a majority of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or someone's just completely shut it down. And then in those cases, I have left the organization, like straight up. It's taken a couple months, but I've realized, okay, this is me between a rock and a hard place. I'm gone because there's no give. And that's not fun to work at. That's not significant. That's not, I have no agency. I have no dignity because I'm just following the leader. And that's not fun or engaging for me as an employee.
Right. And, you know, again, what he talks about, what are the characteristics of the best meeting? And this is what he says: clear intent and standards, contributions over attendance,
interesting.
Paying attention to what needs to be done and then doing it.
Yeah. So I can speak to many parts of this point. If a meeting doesn't have an agenda, I don't join it. That's what I say. So if I'm usually making the meetings, so I put my own agenda in, it can be 2 points. It can be 4 points. It doesn't have to be a crazy draft agenda with perfect headings and
no.
But if a meeting doesn't have an agenda, I don't join it. And I say, I message them and say, what are we talking about in this meeting? If someone sends me a request.
Right.
Because I don't want to join something where I'm blindsided with crate, like, don't do that to me. I don't want to do that to you. Don't do that to me.
I don't know. I was trying to figure out what contributions over attendance meant. Like, I didn't.
So if someone can't make a meeting for whatever reason, but they send you an email that says, sorry, I couldn't make the meeting, but here's a whole bunch of ideas that I had in my discussion points that you could contribute to the group. Great. What? Yeah. Okay. But I mean, but that's going back to like turning cameras off, like attendance. Right. So if people are showing up to your meeting and they aren't present and they, or like they just miss a whole bunch of meetings, that starts to be a discussion topic to me about, are they a good fit for this company?
Well, because if they're not attending or making a contribution,
then what's the point of having them on the team? And then they're dragging the team down, which is making them insignificant probably.
Yep. And the bottom thing to me is about my rule where every meeting that I conducted had minutes, and the minutes said, this is what is happening. Like, this is kind of the gist of what was said in the meeting, and this is who's responsible, and this is where it's going from here. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, what's the point?
Right. We always say next steps. Mm-hmm. So what are the next? And I know it's probably cheesy corporate lingo.
No, but we always use the word action items.
Sure. Action items, next steps. But if they're, so at the end of the meeting, when the call's wrapping up and you can tell everyone's like getting ready to go, the countdown timer in Microsoft Teams or Zoom is going, your meeting has 5 minutes left. That's when it starts to spark the conversation. Okay, we've talked about all this stuff. We've hit everything on our agenda. What's the next steps? What are we doing next? And usually that's me saying, okay, I'm booking a meeting with this person to talk about this next problem that we have to solve, or I'm booking this gear next, and I'm sending in a production schedule to this person. Yeah. That's my next steps. I have a list of 3 items to complete. I will do that before the end of the day.
Right.
And then we're laughing because we had an agenda. We had people contribute sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then we just get the stuff done that needs to be done. And maybe it's a longer timeline. Like that's a short example of a timeline.
A lot of the things you're working on.
You don't have to get it done at the end of the day. That's a little bit ridiculous.
No, but it depends.
Depends on the thing.
Like a lot of your projects are more long term.
No, but so then for me, the next sometimes actionable items is, okay, I need to reach out to these 3 people with an email.
Sure. What can I do today to move the long term project forward?
Yeah.
Would be what I would, because if you're meeting about something and then you're not doing anything about that meeting or having any next steps that same day, I say, what's the point of meeting?
And even when it, for us, like we do a lot of brainstorming meetings.
Sure.
So my actionable step is, okay, I'm going to send everybody the brainstorm. I want you to prioritize these, rank these so that I know what the top two priorities are.
Sweet.
Right. Yeah. And I think
that's
other thing
is actionable items to do. Like, that's
if
great.
People don't see meetings being productive, they lose their agency and their dignity. Because they're like, okay, we've met 10 times.
And nothing's been done.
And you know what that's like, right? Because that was one of the issues that you felt was a big thing when you started your job.
Mm-hmm.
That people were like, okay, we've been talking about this for 10 years.
Yeah.
Like, it might be time to
do something. Something that sparks, like, with agency and dignity and that kind of meeting protocol, since I worked a project-to-project basis, I really love the line, and I used it when I was teaching, is to be the driving force on everything you do.
Yeah.
And that is just good advice to be. But if you don't have someone who's a driving force on something, it never gets done, and you have 10 meetings and nothing's been accomplished.
So then
and
you're sitting become in the driving
force. So then if you notice that happening, you become the driving force.
Well, and he says in his book that one of the things that is we should be part of the culture in our workplaces is, and that we should be teaching people to do, is doing more than it's expected.
Yeah.
And I think, like, as parents, we tried to raise you guys as not
to go above and beyond.
Things, like, to always look for a way to go above and beyond.
And sometimes it doesn't make sense to do that. And I get that. In certain places or organizations, if you're working at Wendy's, do you want to go above and beyond? No, like probably not. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there are some cases to try to, but then, if you start going above and beyond, then they notice you and then maybe you become a manager. Like, who knows?
If that's your,
and then you make,
and just your example of driving force, like amongst the janitorial crew at the college, there are two or three people that smile. They're going in and cleaning dirty washrooms. Yet when they come out, they say, hi, good morning. And then I had a student say to me, like, she goes, my best friend was so-and-so, the cleaner, because I had lots of conversations with him about everything. And I learned so much about Canadian culture just by talking to him. And I thought he valued international students and had a conversation with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I don't know his name, but it's the guy that you recorded his accordion group.
Oh my gosh. Oh yeah, that gentleman specifically at the college is a phenomenal custodian and just an amazing, talented person. He worked with the famous accordion player that has a movie made about him.
Yeah.
I don't know.
The Polish guy from St. Catharines.
Yeah, he's very famous. He's a bunch of movies.
So what is your definition then of true service?
True service?
Yeah.
Like customer service is what I'm thinking of.
Because he does a whole thing in the book about customer service. And he has that with the car wash. There's a story in there about a car wash. I don't know if you remember it.
Yes.
Where the guy hired disabled people.
Oh, yes.
To run his car wash. And they ended up being the most popular
car wash
in the area. And it was basically just because of the service of what he taught his people to just give what the customer what they want.
Yep.
It's that whole thing of the customer is always right. Like, whatever, you're trying to meet the needs of the customer.
Yes. I say a couple things to that.
98%.
The customer is always right.
No.
Sometimes the customer doesn't know.
But sometimes the customer doesn't know, and you have to educate them on that.
Right. I mean, a difference between washing a car.
But full service, true service, is educating your client on what they need to know in order for the success of the business, the whatever. You have to educate educate that client.
And I'm going to give an example of when I first became a principal and I was assigned a school that was very high end.
Yep.
Like, it had parents that I felt would be very well informed about the curriculum.
Yeah, sure.
And I got there and I found out that they actually knew nothing.
Right.
And so I educated, this is what your child's classroom should look like. This is what they should be bringing home. This is what they're learning in math.
And why are they not?
And so that way, I felt that I was giving them true service because I was telling them, like, what they were coming to me about was, why aren't there microwaves in the classroom?
Right.
Who cares? Like,
yeah, who cares?
That doesn't going to make your kid into a better student.
Right. They can heat up their lunch, which might feed them and fuel them for the day, which might make them a better student. But
the problem was that then these kids were bringing like bowls of soup and spilling them all, like grade two kids.
They needed to be educated. There needed to be a microwave class, and then they could put them.
I'm just saying, if people don't know, then sometimes they're asking you for things as part of your service that are ridiculous.
Yeah, and I mean, I from the side, like, another part of true service would be like if there's a competitor. So I work in the AV space in Toronto, and there's lots of competitors that do the same service, probably the exact same way, and you'd get the same product out of it most of the time. What we do that's different is if a client that we trust, okay, sure, you look at the price tag on our stuff, it's expensive. They go to a different company, wow, it's so much cheaper. Why? And they come to us and we spend the time educating them, going line by line through their invoices or quotes and saying, hey, yeah, like this is fine. Like this will work for you, but you're missing a couple items on this that might affect your event. And we'll be honest about that. They could do it the same way.
Yeah.
But we're going to there's no promise.
You're a step up.
But we'll probably do it better.
Yeah.
And it's not. You know, nasty. It's not petty with other company. It's just, hey, this is what your quote, you're being quoted on this. That's a fair price. But listen, it's probably not going to end up being the same image or picture for your event or final product that you want. And that's fine. If you want to go for that cheaper solution,
but you're giving them a choice.
We're educating them.
And I think that's another thing about what true service is about, that you explain the person's choices.
And saying, yeah, it is more expensive for sure. You got us. But we are more expensive, but here's why.
These are your clear choices, right? Like it's when you go to buy a pair of shoes or something or a set of golf clubs and the person explains, well, this is what you'll get out of this. And this is what you're going to get out of the set that's $599. And
yes. And what isn't true service is a sales type person selling something knowing that they're just getting commission and just making a deal.
Right, exactly.
I would rather...
Upselling.
And every business has to do it to make money. We get it. But you can upsell in honest ways.
Yeah.
You can be honest about the final product in a way that you can still upsell it. If you're a good salesperson, I believe you can do that without being like sleazy about it. Absolutely. You can just say, this is more expensive, 100%. I'm going to make a good commission off of that. If you buy that, it's a way better product than X.
Because
of, you know, ABC. Whatever. Like, be honest, and people will probably buy more of your stuff. Or, it's not a sales podcast right now, but that's true
so
service.
What do you look for in a coach or a mentor for yourself?
For myself? Yeah. Direct communication, honesty, and understanding when a mistake is made.
Yeah.
Those three things.
Like compassion when a mistake is made?
Not compassion. You can say,
say that was stupid,
but
you haven't lost your job.
But know that everyone in every capacity is still learning and figuring it out. And no one really knows what they're doing if they're honest.
Right.
So
not
any coach or mentor that's screaming at you and saying, or like even threatening to get rid of your job is not a mentor worth keeping.
Or is unavailable to you.
Well, yeah, then they're not a mentor. They're just a boss.
Yeah.
Or someone who just doesn't respond to emails very well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what do you feel the most important skills that you bring to your workplace environment are? Because he talks a lot about like the new kind of soft skills that...
What the young people bring.
I think I bring a lot of just, as silly as it sounds, just crazy positive energy all the time. And it's not to a point of where I'm burning myself out with positive energy. It's not a fake positivity. It's just, I haven't defined it yet, but I think it's like a direct positivity is what I would call it, what I would define it as. And it's just
but to me, that
me bringing because I think there's lots of times in lots of situations where there's lots of complaints in my industry because, oh, this client's not responding to this email. This is going wrong on this show. And I have a realization very early on that it's everything will go wrong and is going to go wrong. And you can either live like that and be sad and negative in it, or you can just flip and say, nope, I'm going to just be ready to solve it when it comes, and who cares?
But that to me is like you're bringing that ingenuity, positivity, problem solving, like those kinds of skills to the table.
Right.
And those, like, he talks a lot about the difference between, like, you can have a really skilled person, and he calls them tricksters, who just bring everybody down.
Yep.
They don't, like, and he feels like
they're kept,
you should...
They're kept in a company because they know the skills, but they're...
Oh, yeah.
They would be better for the rest of the company if they didn't work there because of how negative they are.
But 80% of, I think, any percent of any job is just people skills, and then the 20% is...
Because you can always learn.
What software you know, like all that crap. Like if you know Excel, great, that's 20%. Cool. But if you don't have people skills, if you can't sit in a group of people and work with them and pull ideas out of people or input ideas, then there's no point.
But he's talking about things like creativity and like all those kinds of skills that...
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm creative.
And he's also talking about people being taught those skills. Like that it's, we're actually in a time in society when we actually need to start teaching those skills again.
Right.
Sure.
Because people are not.
Yeah. I know what a parabola is, but I was never taught, I was never taught people skills. I mean, other than just learning it in school you go and
but
being
no,
parented
no
correctly.
Explicit.
But no, like there should definitely be some sort of in college or high school, a people skills course and how to work with a team. And those things get taught. But there are some people that don't get it still.
Yeah. And I mean,
As mean as that sounds, but it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And then he talks a lot about how like developing a culture in the workplace. And it's very similar to like trying to have a culture where what is more important is the actual people skills. Because if you have those kinds of skills and those kinds of cooperation in place, then the skill part comes easier, like the work.
And
so developing culture in the workplace.
It'd be interesting to know what you think. How does a company develop a really good culture?
I think the problem that arises is immediately saying the word develop. You can't develop a good culture, I don't believe. I think you have to organically create one with creating an open workplace that you're allowed to work from home. You're allowed to create your own opportunities. If you follow everything on the top of the list that we talked about, you'll have a good culture.
Well,
I think that's the
think
backwards
comes,
thinking that
I think
people
it
want
also
this great
comes
culture.
Down to, like for me, when I was working as a principal, social was what supposedly developed the good culture.
Like,
going out and doing things together.
And that's great. That's fine.
It's fine. But, and I'm going to say that in my particular place, people were being paid super well. So I think the number one thing about making your, having a good culture where people want to contribute and, you know, do all that is to actually pay people what they're worth. And if
when
you do that,
that helps for sure.
And a living wage based on what
then people
the
can think
are.
About things like, oh, I do want to go out after work because I can, you know, afford rent and groceries and all
I
these
don't
things.
Have to go for my next part-time job.
But
to,
I also think that culture also comes from that idea that I am here to make, to contribute something better and make like what he says, what is significance? It's caring about what you're doing and doing something that matters. Work that matters is significant.
Right.
So the culture does not need to come from going whitewater rafting together, which...
That builds rapport and friendship and thing, which is great to have in a workplace.
But the actual culture
Yeah.
comes from what you are doing. and making it significant and what matters.
Right.
Like, for me, I had a hard time not getting that the people in my building were not concerned about the success of the children.
Right.
But that they were more
the
concerned
main part of a school?
About going yeah. out for drinks on Friday night. And yeah. that was what was
that's significant
to them,
which is wrong.
Which is, you've got to care about the work you're doing and do something that matters. And we could
say it's as easy as finding people that care about that stuff, but that's harder than it seems. Like if it's like, there are lots of people out in the world that will just do a job because of the cool things that they do outside of the office.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and, they work to live
and yeah, there's definitely a weird cross section of both those things. Yeah. It's about what's in the, what we're doing today.
I was a waiter for a long time, needing to make money to pay for university. And I could have had the attitude of, ugh, I'm just doing this because I need the cash.
Right.
But I still had the idea that I wanted to help these people have a good evening out. And I know
part of it was... But what gave you that idea?
I don't know. And it wasn't even to get a good tip. It was...
Right.
It was just...
Well, that was probably...
Because then I had a better day if that's how I thought.
You
I
had acted. A better day.
Work, yeah.
Work that matters.
Because like, you felt significant.
And I think what Seth Godin would say, if you don't have that about what you're doing, then
change
you're not
jobs.
Doing the right thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, so that's. I think that's a huge issue, and this goes to a whole different conversation
sorry,
in a different podcast.
Ahead. Yeah,
but it's people in the world, like young people specifically, going to study a job because that's what their guidance counselor told them to do.
Right,
mm-hmm. But it is not described to them in a way of, this is a really cool job opportunity. You get to do X, Y, Z when you finish school. Mm-hmm. It's. Oh, this is a really good degree. You'll make a lot of money.
Well, right. And the difference.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
And there's lots of parents that are like that too. That are like, oh, we just want to put you through this program to be a doctor because that makes a lot of money. But if they hate being a doctor, they're not going to feel significant. And then that's why things fail and organizations fail because there's that.
But he
those
does
people
talk
out there.
About that a lot. Like if you can't get yourself to feel a significance in your job.
Switch jobs.
You can't care about it. And he also talks about how...
I had a hard time trimming pine trees and feeling significant.
Yeah.
Right. But I mean...
So you shouldn't be doing that, really, because somebody would find
stone.
That...
But I know that there are landscapers who would like thrive on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's... So it's a matter of finding that. And the last point I just wanted to talk... And he does talk about how... People of your generation, particularly, are going to move from job to job.
Oh, way more frequently.
Way more frequently. So the final one I just wanted to say is, what do you do to move past mistakes? Like to get past when you've made a mistake?
Oopsie whoopsie and move on.
What does that mean?
Just say oopsie whoopsie and try again the next time. I don't know. I mean, that's
but,
like...
And you're obviously not... No one's coming down on you hard.
But say...
Oh, if it's a big mistake and someone comes down on you about it, usually in those cases, you're usually completely oblivious to what happened.
So just think a couple jobs ago when
you
made a mistake and the client and you had to come up with a solution that was a band-aid solution, but there was no other solution for the client and the client still was happy with you in the final outcome. Like the audio, you didn't do the audio.
Oh, or the audio didn't record properly or messed up, which is a scary thing to talk about on a podcast. Thank you very much. So this better work. No, but I think the solution is you just immediately become open and honest about the mistake. Yeah. Immediately.
But how many days do you think that kind of weighed you down and made you like upset?
In the beginning, like a week. After a week or 2 weeks, I would still think about that one job because the saying in my industry is you're only as good as your last production, which is a very
that's
very
pressure.
Red flag.
I would say
pressure.
Here's the saying in education, you're only as good as your most difficult student.
Yeah. So, I mean, it keeps us humble and honest.
Yeah.
But I don't think you need to like bear down your entire career with that line in any job. Like if there's a specific.
And don't you think that's a lot to do with your own mindset?
Yes.
Like not letting your thoughts.
And we have a very loud neighbor.
Welcome to motorcycle land.
Hey, it's fine. I mean, they're just,
Anyway, not like actually.
They're feeling significant on their bikes.
I can see that. But sad. Not, but your sad own mindset. Sad that that's what brings them to your own mindset, like not letting those thoughts control you and just.
Yeah. And realizing early on, I think that no one tells you is that everyone does not know what they're doing. Like everybody right. in every career really does not know what they're doing.
Yeah. 100% of the time.
100% yeah. of the time.
I hope my doc, my surgeon knows.
Oh, yeah. Okay. When you get to those kind of jobs, yes, they do know something. But for the most part, we're all learning. We're all figuring it out. So if you keep that in the back of your mind, you make a mistake. Well, okay. Everyone else is going to probably learn from that mistake. Or also they've made it in the past and they're like, oh, darn. Yeah, that happened to me a couple of years ago. And we'll work to make it not happen again.
And I think that's a big thing in leadership, right, is learning how to train the people underneath, like who are working for you or with you, to see mistakes as learning opportunities. Like that's a huge leadership.
As cheesy thing. As it is, yeah.
It's a huge learning. It is cheesy, but it's important. So anyway, that's our kind of discussion, unless somebody can think of something else. I think that's a lot of the points you made. And I would highly recommend that if you are working as a leader or you have a company, that this is a really good book to read.
And the one point that didn't come up that I would love to just like put a button on for all organizations and all leadership, if they're listening to this, is working from home will not change your culture. Working from home is the new future. If you do not get ahead of it, you will be left behind.
Yep.
And that's just the way it's going. If you hate it, if you are seething listening to this right now and you say, everyone has to come in, change your mindset, read the book, educate yourself, because it is going to change. And if you don't follow, it'll take you out.
People will quit working for you and then you won't have anybody.
If you have a kind of a business or something where it is important for people to come in, then you have to figure out ways to make
it worth their while.
Significant and worth their while to come there.
In. Yeah. And not just saying, it's great in the office.
No.
Because every office is great to be in, if that's your argument.
I also, there are places where it would be better if people came in more, but I also think that you have to.
I still don't think so. I still will argue every single time. If you can join a Zoom meeting, if you can join a Teams meeting, if you can chat with someone on a Zoom chat, Teams chat, whatever, Slack,
there, you can that's still the word.
Be
Slack.
Slack chat. you can still be as productive every time. It's just true. And if people aren't,
But the thing about Zoom and Slack and Reddit chats and everywhere other ones is if you're not on, like, there's a lot of things that happen when you walk past each other in the hallway and you say, let's grab a coffee. And until it becomes the norm while you're on Zoom and you see names scrolling up on the Slack feed and you're like, so-and-so, I haven't talked to him for a long time. And you say, hey, do you have 15 minutes, let's have tea on camera and talk.
That happens all the time in my organization. It's not.
Yes, but it doesn't in my generation. I'm going to end crazy. With this because I'm going to say that it doesn't matter how your organization is functioning, whether everyone's coming in or everyone's online, what you have to be measuring is significance, productivity, whether people are caring, whether people are engaged, whether they are doing work that matters and moves the organization forward. And if people are not coming in and that's not happening, then maybe you may better relook at things. But if you're in an organization where people are online all the time and all those things are happening, then you should be sitting back and thanking your lucky stars that you have people in your organization that have found agency, dignity, and significance. And that's
perfect way to end it.
Nice. Yeah. All right. And then so for August, we actually are going to do our back to school episode, and I've invited my friend Rita to come on.
Another former principal.
Educator. And we're going to talk about back to school. So that will be August 15th. So thanks for joining us on No Room for Phonies and Sebastian and the Song of Significance.
My album will be dropping. No, I'm just kidding.
Good night.